everybody. This is Andy Marquette. I am joined by my colleague, Liz McTagg. We are Liz Geek Out, where we do the geekly bi-weekly thing. That's Liz's thing, and I love it. And we talk about all kinds of geekly weekly things. So, Liz, how are you doing?
I am doing awesome, though I do have to let our listeners know, if you hear a weird noise in the background, Mr. Wheatley is hanging out on my desk, and he's snoring a bit. It's pretty quiet. I'm hoping it doesn't pick it up, but if it does, now you know.
Now you know, and as a reminder, Mr. Wheatley is a kitty cat. Yellow kitty cat. Or orange. Orangey, yellow? He's orangey.
Yes, he's orange. He's orange. Nah, he's the random dude who lives in my house.
Yeah, like, some dude who comes in, stretches out on Lisa's desk, snores, you know, like that.
Like happens.
Like that. All right, friends. This week, well, as we tweeted on our Twitterness, Lisa and I read the first volume of the graphic novel Monstrous, which is actually a series of comics put out by Image Comics. And Monstrous is sort of a play on Monstrous, M-O-N-S-T-R-O-U-S, versus the actual title of the series, which is Monstress, M-O-N-S-T-R-E-S-S, Monstrous. So Lisa and I were trying to figure out how best to describe this, because it is something that kind of defies description. So I went online and I found an interview with the writer, Marjorie Liu, in The Atlantic, and it has a really kind of a decent description. So I'm going to read this to you, friends, because otherwise Lisa and I would be like, and then this, and then that. Uh-huh. Oh yeah. And then there was this, and then, oh my God, that. So,
oh, and another thing.
And then another thing. Like, so here's a really good overview. The comic book series Monstrous introduces its haunted heroine, Maika. She has the look of someone just barely surviving. Maika, half-wolf, that's one word, half-wolf, is naked, missing part of an arm, wearing a metal collar, and being sold at a slave auction, a casualty in a bloody conflict between humans and Arcanics, a race of magical creatures. Of course, Maika is more than she seems. She's an Arcanic who looks human, enraged by her mother's death, her missing memories, and the atrocities she has suffered. There's also a strange, deadly power taking root in her body and mind, hence the Monstrous, one she can't understand or control. So it's been described as sort of a matriarchal Asia. Maika's universe is wracked by a race war and inhabited by violent witch nuns, vicious deities, and innocent civilians, all of which is brought to life by artist Sana Takeda's exquisite manga-style Art Deco-inspired art. So it's an epic fantasy. There's magic, though, involved, and sort of steampunk elements. Mm-hmm. You know, as we watch the witch nuns doing their science creepiness, but there's also cat wizards who talk, like, you know, and there's these half human, these hybrid beings that are, they look human, but they have like animal, some of them have animal features, like Kippa, who's the fox girl, and I with a big long fox tail. And the cat wizards often have more than one tail, which sort of tells you that they're not your regular garden variety cat. Although I think there are garden variety cats in the world, because there was a comment made in like episode 2, I think it was issue 2, but about a cat, you know. So it was like, are you a regular cat, or, you know, like that. So anyway, that's the overview. And from the very first panels, you're like, what the ever-loving fuck is happening in this story? Mm-hmm. And the best way to approach this, I think, is just to just read it and let it wash over you like a tide, because just go with it. And I guarantee you will be sucked right into the story. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Liz to talk about some of the art of Takeda's art, because it is really freaking amazing.
It is freaking amazing. Her style is really intricate and, you know, detailed. And, you know, it has the Art Deco, sort of that Art Nouveau feel to it, which is a really interesting style to bring into sort of this kind of medium. We don't see that very often, mm-hmm. probably because, you know, it is really intricate. It's hard to draw, you know, consistently at that level over and over and over again for every panel. And yet Takeda totally manages to keep that going. One of the things I love about the art is that it feels really layered. Mm. Like there are all of these things going on. And
what do you mean, like in terms of style or in terms of story or both?
Both. So I feel like, you know, the in any good graphic novel, you can't really separate the art from the writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is definitely one of those cases, right, where, you know, each informs the other, or at least it seems to. They're really tightly melded. No, it's just, you know, there's a lot going on. A lot of the panels are really detailed. You get a whole lot about the world and the world building just through, like, what's going on in the background, especially at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. Where mm-hmm. they're really sort of grounding us in this new world. And then as we go further on, you start to see, you know, differences for different parts of the world. Like the Human Federation is kind of like sort of visually decayed. Like the colors are more muted and more neutral, and, you know, things are like chipped and broken. And then you see the Arcanid side of things, mm-hmm. and the colors are like brighter, and there's not as much sort of like grime covering everything. Mm-hmm. And then we see, like, the Ancients tech, which is way more advanced than anything they have now. And that's where, like, the Art Deco and the Art Nouveau feel kind of really comes to the fore. And it's a lot sort of prettier and less visually decayed than anything in, you know, from current day.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's a really great sort of visual metaphor to show, like, just how advanced the ancients were and how fucked up everything is right now.
Isn't that always the truth, though? And one mm-hmm. of the things, so you've got three, I don't want to say races. I'm not sure that's accurate, but you've got the Arcanas. Or is that how, God, you know, it's like, like I said, just let it wash over you, people. Just trust us.
Uh-huh.
just like, because that's the only way you're going to, like, really be able to absorb this. And I think that's probably how it's supposed to be. Like, I'm looking at another summary here that the series is set in a matriarchal world inspired by early 20th century Asia. And you definitely get those feelings from the art and from how it's visually presented. Mm-hmm. So you've got, like, these hybrids, human and like old gods, kind of. And then you've got the witch nuns who are tinkering with really fucked up science and like basically experimenting on people with this mm-hmm. stuff. And
yeah, and cannibalizing them
right?
for their own power.
Right. It's just like, ew. And then, so you've got like, those are, and then you've got the, well, those are the Kumeya, the witch nuns, mm-hmm. the sorceresses. And they basically literally consume the Arcanics to fuel their power. So right. it's like, ew, gross. So you've got like, and the Kumeya think of the Arcanics as like, you know, a beings who are less than.
Unclean.
Unclean. So it doesn't matter what they do to them and torture them and like, you know, hurt them, kill them. They just don't care. That's like, mm-hmm. whatever, you know? So you have like this whole setup of like a really horrific, you know, the beginnings of a race war. And the very first volume, which is what, 6 issues of the comic, will take you into the setup for this race war. And you're it kind of makes you wonder like, well, was it really the Arcanics who kind of drove them to this? Or is there something else underneath all of this that nobody is seeing? So there's like these elements that maybe it's not a war started by the Arcanics. Maybe the Kumeya are actually pulling some strings, but you're not really sure. You know, is anybody ever really sure when war like this breaks out? I think there's like all these gray areas.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the story seems pretty black and white when you first get started, right? Especially because, you know, you're there with Maika and she's being sold into slavery to these people who are going to like chop her limbs off. So that they can be powerful. That's pretty messed up. So, you know, you feel like, okay, these are the bad guys, and that must mean that the Arcanics are the good guys. Except the further we go along in the story, the grayer things get. And then it's sort of like,
yeah,
okay,
that's a good point.
You know, who is the good guy? And we're not even sure if our main character is the good guy.
She is like a total anti-hero. And I really love that because I'm like, I'm not sure I like her.
No.
I'm not sure I trust her, you know? And my favorite character right now is Ren the Cat Wizard and Kippa the Fox Girl. Those are my favorite characters. But I also, and then you, as the story progresses, you also find out that there are elements at play among the Kamea that are actually working against the Kamea. So you've got like some serious like Game of Thrones intrigue going on throughout in both the Kamea and the Arcanix. And then
the Arcanix are not a monolith. I mean, they have it seems like a number of different factions. And no one likes the Human Federation, but the Arcanix don't necessarily work super well among themselves.
Yeah, I know that when the first issues of Monstrous were issued, I'm trying to sum up the major themes. I remember I read something on Kotaku about it. And the article said that it's a gorgeous comic book about racism, slavery, and war. And that's literally what it's about. So these are themes that are relevant in our world. You know, you don't need an epic fantasy to explore those themes, but an epic fantasy, of course, gives you that platform to do that. And bringing in these elements of the steampunk kind of like intertwined with the magic. I mean, and we're talking serious magic and talking like links to old gods. I mean, this is like, it is like, how the fuck does this all work together? It does. And I think, like you were saying, it's because the art provides the visual and then the way the story kind of moves through these worlds and through the art, you're just like fucking sucked in. I could not put this down.
The world building is something else. I mean, and this is intricate. I mean, there are layers upon layers upon layers.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't read the next two books.
I have not. And so if you want to speak a little bit to those about how the story progresses, but don't, no spoilers now.
No, I'm not going to spoil anything. It's just, you know, that world building continues. You know, we get deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's like this is a it's a freaking onion, you know, but just layers to peel off and peel off, and man, it gets more awesome the deeper you go.
It also has it's racked up numerous awards. It's won in the British Fantasy Award, the Eisner Awards, which is the American Comic Book Awards, the Harvey Awards, and the Hugos. I mean, this thing is award winning. And one of the things that I want to point out in terms of, you know, because Lisa and I are big into representation, one of the things that is so cool about this is that there are hardly any male characters and hardly any white characters.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I love that. I freaking love it. I mean, you're just brought into this world where you're just like, wow. And everybody, almost everybody who's good or evil, and you don't know for sure who's good and evil because there's so many, everybody's so damaged. I mean, this is a story of damaged people, and most of them are women. And some of these women are horrifically cruel and commit horrific atrocities against other beings. Just to demonstrate, and I think Marjorie Liu, the writer, said in an interview that she was talking about that she wanted to explore what a world would look like with mostly women. And she said, basically, you know, women are human and they're going to fall into shitty patterns and create problems just as, you know, we complain male worlds do. And that was a really interesting take, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but what's the saying? Power corrupts.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love that we are literally dropped right into the middle of this. I mean, that's sort of a space opera approach. You know, you just drop your reader right in, boom, and your reader's like, oh, fuck, what am I doing in here? I got to figure this out. And that's how this works. You're dropped at the slave auction and you're like, okay, here are the main players here. What's going on? And then like by the book two, you're like, oh my God, who are these people? What's happening? So that's why I say just let it read it and let it wash over you. Let the tide wash over you. Let the tide of this book just wash over you, because otherwise you don't get caught up in trying to deconstruct it at first blush. Just read it and let it kind of settle with you. And it was a different kind of experience for me, because normally, like in a comic book, you know, there's like clues, right, Lise? That, mm-hmm. you know, this is where we're going, la, 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 la. You don't get those clues here. You're just like, boom. And then I found myself thinking, holy shit, there's a talking cat with two tails. And I was like, strangely, it works. And the cat says, fuck, you know, and strangely, it all works. It's just like, this is working for me. I don't know how, but it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that this book has going for it is, you know, because it is so visually different, a lot of our expectations for comics or graphic novels are stripped away right from the get-go, you know, because it's not manga, and it's certainly not, you know, like that the Marvel DC. It's its own thing, and it gives it the space to sort of explore these things without us having a whole bunch of preconceived notions to, like, squish on top of it.
That's a really good way to describe it. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the background of the writer and the artist. Marjorie Liu, some of you may know her. She's a New York Times bestselling author who has written a lot of urban fantasy. But she's also a comic book writer and has worked for Marvel and on stuff like Dark Wolverine and Astonishing X-Men. So, I mean, this ain't no slacker in the comics world, mm-hmm. you know. So in that regard, you know, she's been around quite a while doing a lot of really interesting things in terms of storylines. So when we move into Sana Takeda, she is a Japanese illustrator and comic book artist. She's best known for Monstrous, of course, but before that, she did comics for a while. She worked in the Marvel Universe for a while. And then I guess was told that her style was too manga. And, you know, obviously it is, if you look at Monstrous. So she ended up working in, like, the gaming industry, doing, I guess, graphic design for the gaming industry. And then Marjorie Liu was like, hey, no, let's do this other project. Let's work on Monstrous together. That'll be awesome. Because apparently they had worked together prior to that. And so she was like, sure, let's do it. And the result is exquisite and mm-hmm. incredible and mind-boggling. I mean, I have never read a graphic novel like this. This is like defies description, but it sits in your brain.
It does. It defies description. It defies genre.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a mashup of so many different genres that you just sort of lose track of, like, okay, what is it all pulling from? And it becomes its own thing.
Yeah.
Which it's fantastic when people can do that.
And do it effectively, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so that it works. Like, all of these really disparate elements that should not work together do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and they've pulled from mythology, but it looks like mythology is sort of across the board. You know, there are Western European mythology that's called out that I recognize, and there's like Egyptian mythology, and, you know, I'm not up on Asian mythology, but, you know, that's in there too.
Mm-hmm. And the Egyptian mythology, when there's these interludes in the comics, friends, like at the last page of each issue, there's like a cat wizard, and so there's some link to poetry as well. Like, being a poet mm-hmm. is some, it's, they're like the philosophers of this world. So there's this cat wizard, kind of the great renowned, you know, whatever cat wizard explaining whatever. So there's like this really kind of matronly looking cat mm-hmm. with little kittens, and she's describing how things are set up in the world. So you get sort of kind of an overview tour of the mythos surrounding this world through this like matronly cat. And at that point, well, when the Ren the cat wizard appeared, I immediately thought, okay, maybe this is like some kind of Egyptian stuff going on, because that the eye symbol, the cat, you know, and sure enough, that you start seeing more of that brought in through the visuals. But mm-hmm. but it's not definitive, because there's so many other things mishmashed in there. Let's talk violence.
It is. It's very violent, and, you know, and we see a lot of it.
Yes, we do.
the artist does not shy away from depicting that, which I think it is appropriate in the story that they're trying to tell. You know, a lot of it is about the horrors of war, the terrible things that people do to each other in the pursuit of power. And sort of sanitizing that violence, I think, would take away a lot of the effectiveness mm-hmm. of that imagery and that message. But yeah, there are definitely things that happen that are not for the faint of heart.
Definitely not. You know, one of the other things that I was thinking about was this overarching theme of war and how, and also racism, mm-hmm. these two themes and how they play a role in the, I mean, let's just say it, the Khmer, they're sadistic. They are sadistic sorceresses. And the things that they are doing are harkened back to Nazi experimentation and just really horrific things. And you think about how, in a world that is defined by a racism like that, it creates the platform for perpetual war. I mean, mm-hmm. this is literally, you know, you see kind of how these elements feed each other, how war feeds racism and racism in turn feeds these wars. And I don't know, it just was like, it kind of left me thinking, oh man, like you know, this is basically our history right here. This ain't no alternate universe. This is like what we see around us every freaking day.
It is. And, you know, in the story, the Cumaea spend so much time sort of othering and doing everything they can to cast the Arcanics as these things that are not mm-hmm. worthy of, you know, freedom of life, of anything aside from what they can suck out of them and then spit out. And it makes me wonder, anyway, what happens if the Khmer are successful? What if they manage to wipe out all the Arcanics?
And then what, right?
Then what? They've made themselves up to combat this engineered threat. So when the threat is gone, what are they going to turn on next? Because they have to turn on something. That's how they work.
Well, that's what feeds racism like mm-hmm. that. I mean, and what happens that, you know, literally what happens when you have nobody else left to racism against? What do you do with that?
Yeah. You turn inward.
You probably turn against each other. And it seems like, you know, there is a resistance among the Khmer. And we find mm-hmm. that out, and I was like, oh, intriguing, plot twist, like, you know. But it kind of makes sense that there would be, because isn't that the case for most, mm-hmm. most you know, organizations or situations, is that you'll have, like, the power-driven people, and you'll have the autocracy in place, and the ones who are implementing power and grinding everybody down. But there's always somebody within that system that mm-hmm. knows it's fucked up and is doing something to combat it. I think that's one of the other themes that I would ascribe to this series, is that perseverance of the human spirit, not just through Mayka, who is mm-hmm. like obviously been horrifically brutalized. And now she's got this thing inside her. Right? Mm-hmm. That is like maybe an old god, maybe not. We are not quite sure. Yeah,
we don't really know.
We don't really know.
And at the very, very beginning, she doesn't even really know what's going on. Right. You know, she knows that something is wrong and sometimes things happen, but she doesn't know why and she doesn't know how. And then as shit starts to unravel, the thing inside of her is, like, makes itself known to her. And then it's like, oh, fuck, what are we actually dealing with? And it's incredibly powerful, but who is it in service of? Is it in service of her? Is it in service of itself?
We don't know. That's what, at least I don't. Mm-hmm. You might know because you've read further. But like, at this point in the first volume, I don't know what this thing is all about. But I do like how clues are dropped into the storyline. Mm-hmm. Like you see, like maybe there's a connection to the Khmer, maybe. And then you think, well, maybe there's a connection to the gods who were mating with humans to create the Arcanics. Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure. At least I don't. which I find really interesting. And another thing I want to talk about is the antihero of, you know, Meika.
Yes.
What drives her seems to me is anger and grief. And those two are often intertwined, depending mm-hmm. on what's happened. And you don't often see a female character who is defined largely by anger in the first, you know, you're introduced to her and you're like, oh, I get why she's angry. She's being sold at auction, you know, and then you get a little bit of her history and you're like, well, hell yeah, I'd be angry too. But it's a female character and female rage. Those are not something that are generally, they're not allowed, you know, to be expressed in our society. So I really liked, as much as I'm not sure what to do with this main character, I'm not sure what her deal is, I really liked seeing the anger displayed, like, throughout the series. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, go girl, be angry. And she's also dealing with that grief, you know, for herself, for her mother, for whoever.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, she has a hell of a lot of uncertainty in her life, which I think also feeds into that anger. Because when she doesn't know what's going on, when she doesn't know what to do, mm-hmm. she typically responds to those situations with anger, you know?
Yeah.
But I also think is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, for sure. But also the other maybe issue there is that this society especially does not allow women of color to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate that element here that, you know, we've got this woman of color, or she's 17. I mean, she's mm-hmm. a young woman. She's lost part of her arm. She's been brutalized and tortured in ways that I've only read the first volume, so I don't know. And then she's got this thing within her. And I read an article trying to describe it, the monstrous, and saying that it was like almost Lovecraftian the way it looked.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was kind of nailed it, because it's not really, you can't even describe it. There's like, you got to read this series, because mm-hmm. it's like, and it's colored dark, you know? So it's this
right.
dark force within her mm-hmm. and we don't know where it came from, how she got it, what it's doing there, and what it plans to do with her.
Right. And yet, you know, I mean, she has all of this shit going on and she's angry, but you don't really get the feeling, or at least I don't, that the thing inside her is a product of her anger.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't come out when she's angry. It comes out when she's in danger, at least initially.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, those are two very different things. And so, you know, she acts fairly, you know, pretty rashly in some cases, trying to force it to come out, because she needs mm-hmm. to put herself in danger so that it can save her ass.
Oh, that's a really interesting aspect that I hadn't considered. I like that. Yeah, like in towards the end of the first volume, when she's put into the sarcophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of this really interesting discussion with it, because mm-hmm. she's in a coma, basically. And yet the two of them are in her mind's eye and they're having a conversation. And that was just like, it should be surreal and like completely like, what the fuck? But it worked. Mm-hmm. So you kind of like, because this thing within her is also searching for answers. That's the right. sense I got. And so mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure, based on my reading of the first volume, where this thing stands, if it's good, if it's bad, what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. And it's damaged also. You know, we get the feeling that it's less than whole at this point.
Oh, yeah. Know? Yeah. That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And wow. It takes on, you know, it takes sort of over her missing arm. And so in some ways, you know, it's completing her.
Grossly and
mm-hmm.
not in, yeah, but
like, in a very Lovecraftian fashion. I mean, like, if you like tentacles, yeah, there you go.
With eyes embedded mm-hmm. throughout. It's like this being that has been, it talks a lot about sleeping. But what's mm-hmm. another really interesting aspect of the being is that it communicates with Meika, and you're not really sure or Meika. I'm going to call her Meika. You're not really sure. You know, it's in her head, so they're sort of communicating through her head, but Kippa can hear it.
Yes.
Kippa, and that to me was really interesting, and maybe that's going to be spooled out further in the next volumes. Mm-hmm. Again, this is my reading of the first one, but that was a really interesting point, and the Raven guy from the Dusk Council noticed that too, and that's why Kippa suddenly got sucked into the, you know, oh, you're coming with us. You know, she may mm-hmm. have been able to get away, but now she's like, but I can hear it too, with her cute little naive self, you know, like, so.
Yep. And there's shit going on there too with the Arcanics and the Dust Council. You know, mm-hmm. their hands are not clean.
Nobody's hands are clean. Nobody. And that's what is so. Jinx, buy me a coat. And that's what's so cool about this series is that, you know, you're put in a situation where nobody is good. Nobody's bad. Because even, you know, although I would argue the Kamea seem pretty fucking bad, but even the people that you think are good are tainted.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, they have beings with wings and like, and unicorns and things that, you know, to at least to my Western mind,
right.
These are associated with like good and purity. And except, you know, the unicorns are being used as mounts by the fuck off humans, and the angel guy, you know, he's
got a dark side.
Uh-huh. There's shit going on there that we don't know about.
So overall, y'all, you know, I mean, pick this up, give it mm-hmm. a look, because this is like unlike anything you have ever read or seen in a visual graphic novel context. And I really think that it is. I mean, it's one of those that you keep thinking about
mm-hmm.
after you've read it. You just like keep thinking about it like, wow, okay. And then you might go back and like, did I miss something? So there, it's just, you can read this one over and over again and get new things from it.
I've really enjoyed rereading this one.
It's amazing. So there was an interview with Marjorie Liu in The Atlantic, and she says, this is what she says about Monstrous. We'll finish up with this. Monstrous is my response to and a product of my frustration with being bombarded by stories I'm told I should be grateful for. Like when we see TV shows where there are a million white people and one Chinese woman, if we're lucky. It's a lie of white supremacy, the visual lie that tells us our heroes, our stories, our love lives, and everything that we aspire to, everything that is heroic and romantic, is white. Being surrounded by that, I think, really deforms the imagination, and it deforms the heart as well. Boom! Mic drop. Read mm-hmm. Monstrous, y'all. I mean, really, do it. It is like, the art is gorgeous. The story is amazing, and the way those two work together, it's a visual feast.
Mm-hmm. And then you can go out and get volumes 2 and 3.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Again, Monstrous, it's put out by Image Comics. All right, Lee, so what have you got going on? Do you got like what's your weekly geek out thing that you're all about this week?
I don't have much, actually. I've been trying to figure out what the hell I've been doing for the past week, and I don't know. I think it's mostly been goofing off. We did start watching Sabrina season 2, and it's been pretty good so far, so I've been enjoying that.
And you finished She-Ra season 2, right?
I did. Oh my god.
Okay, no spoilers, I have to do that.
I'm taking it back. She-Ra season 2 is what I've been doing. It's fucking awesome. And season 3 can't get here soon enough.
Speaking of season 3.
Yes, Gina Davis.
Gina Davis is going to be one of the voices, y'all. What? So if you have not started watching She-Ra, Princesses of Power on Netflix, friends, Noelle Stevenson, why have you not started doing this? Lisa and I raved about season 1, and we're probably going to have to rave about season 2, right? Am I right?
Yep, you're right.
Okay, damn it. Okay, so my thing this week is I have the sads over the finale of Into the Badlands. They ended it. It was not renewed after season 3.
No.
And that was one of the most gorgeously filmed series, I think. I've seen like ever. I mean, it's just gorgeously filmed with stylistic and beautiful fight scenes. It is excruciatingly violent, but the stories were amazing. I do think, however, I saw an article on Autostraddle, you know, doing a post-mortem on it. And I do agree that I think Into the Badlands really did not end up doing its due diligence with its female badass characters and its queer characters. Oh. And so I'm a little bit, you know, been kind of bummed about that. But then I think part of that may be a function of the fact that they were forced to wrap it up after three seasons. Mm. And so, unfortunately, I'm sad about that, but I am watching season two of Killing Eve. So for those of you who have been watching Killing Eve, yay, I live tweet. So I'll be doing that tonight. So if you want to find out all my takes on everything, there you go. But yeah, that's one of the two things that I've been dealing with. And then I'm going to start watching She-Ra season two.
Mm-hmm. So were they able to bring Into the Badlands to a conclusion, even if it was
a conclusion, not all the conclusions that we were hoping for. And it left sort of a something that would have been, I think would have been a jumping off point for a season four.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, that's another one that deals with themes of war and racism and,
mm-hmm.
or like, you know, othering of certain elements. So, I'm so sad to see that one go because it really is a gorgeously filmed series and just well acted. And yeah.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Bummer.
Bummer. Anything else going on, Lise?
That's it for me.
All right, friends, we're going to wrap it up. And we hope you have a great day, whatever you were doing. We are recording this on Mother's Day. If that's something that you're into, happy Mother's Day. If it's not, happy Don't Talk to Your Mother Day. If that's your thing. But if you don't care one way or the other, happy Sunday. And anyway, that was Let's Geek Out. We talked about Monstrous. Oh my God, y'all, read it. Go, you know, definitely pick this one up. And also have a look at She-Ra, Princesses of Power, Season 2. And if you haven't already, Killing Eve. Come on, people, really? And Into the Badlands. It's a finite series, so, you know, you don't have to worry about not being able to catch up. All right, thanks, friends. And you can find us in all the places, right, Lise? Stitcher.
All places.
iTunes. Wherever the hell. And if you do find us in those places, please like and subscribe. You know, give us a little review and whatever. That helps others find us, and we like that. We want others to find us. And you can find us on Twitter, LGO Podcast. Please drop in with us and tell us some ideas, you know, things that you would like us to talk about or things that are on your mind, whatever. We'll chat. We like chatting and talking geek stuff. Mm-hmm. And Lisa,
if you want to come on, let us know.
Yes, that would be awesome. All right, friends, take care of yourselves and have a great week. Bye. I'm tired.
Me too. And Mr. Wheatley did not stay put. I had to go let him out. It's a giant butt.
Damn it, Mr. Wheatley. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's a cat wizard and he had to go deal with stuff.
Well, I could see him being the kind of cat wizard who swears a lot.
Yeah, me too.
He has that face that just says, fuck.
Well, he kind of looked like Ren. And I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, this kitty looks kind of like Mr. Wheatley.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and the expressions that that Takeda drew him with were hilarious. Like, you know, when Kippa, like, grabs him in that last... Oh, man, yes. There you are! And he's like, ah!
Yeah, well, I love when he's trying, like, trying to get out of Kippa's arms.
Yes,
he's
just like doing total cat things.
Uh-huh. And then it's funny, he's like, fine.
That was great. I love that.